it. And actually, they were the bases of this Umayyad dynasty. I mean, in the sense that they reached to power officially, and I think it requires to see how they started to expand corruption, cruelty, and also eliminating the Islamic values like piety and ruling unpious people over the others and choosing people to lead as the governors and commanders of the people, those who did not really actually have the qualifications to be selected as these for these positions. These are, I think, requires to talk about in depth and details, inshallah, in upcoming sessions.
Let me finish this program with a couplet from the famous Persian poet Sanai Ghaznavi. I read it in Persian and translated it into English. داستان پسر هند مگر نشنیدی که از او بر سر اولاد پیامبر چه رسید. Haven't you heard the story of the son of Hind, the wife of Abu Sufyan, that what he did do to the descendants of Prophet Muhammad? پدر او لب و دندان پیامبر بشکست. His father has broken the mouth, the jaws, and the tooth of Prophet Muhammad. مادر او جگر عم پیامبر بمکید.
Hamza
Sayyid al-Shuhada is referring to the uncle of Prophet Muhammad. خود به ناحق حق داماد پیامبر بگرفت. Imam Ali alayhi salam was in fact neglected of his right, that is the right of successorship as imamate. پسر او سر فرزند پیامبر ببرید. He is referring to Yazid, cutting off the head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And this is the last line. بر چنین قوم چرا لعنت و نفرین نکنم؟ Why am I not a cursing and cursing such a tribe? لعن الله یزید و علی آل یزید. May curse be upon Yazid and the descendants of Yazid ibn Muawiyah. This was a couplet done by Sanai Ghaznavi, the famous Persian poet. Really beautiful. And it has all the history from pre-Islamic period, from Abu Sufyan, the father of Muawiyah, up until Yazid ibn Muawiyah. May Allah curse them all. Thank you very much, Dr. Fakhwani and Brother Ali Alavian.
Thanks to you, brother.
For your presence in the program Viewpoints. It was very kind of you. May Allah accept all of our mournings and azadaris and this majalis that we do for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the man who said no to the oppression of Yazid ibn Muawiyah and wanted to revive the pure Muhammadan Islam. For more information on this program, visit our website, parstoday.com/Yankalavislampage. Do not forget us in these supplications and the morning ceremonies and the rallies and demonstrations for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the months of Muharram all across the world. Take care, the pandemic is killing, but held your ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, even if it is online. Brothers, do not forget that these sha'ayr and the rituals has to be enlivened, even if they are digital and online. Do your marasim and majalis and takaya for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. May Allah bless you all. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah al-Hussein.
Look ya Zahra.
Look ya Zahra.
Look ya Zahra. Go back, O honor, they killed my brother. Zaynab said, do not look ya Zahra.
When the night fell on the desert camping, a lonely voice was heard in mourning. Then she looked and saw someone approaching, one who would join her in her grieving. She had come to see her progeny and what had become of their destiny. But she could not let her to go closer. She did not want her to really see I do not want you to go further. You will only see pain and horror. Body with no head, 72 dead. Zainab said, do not look yet.
Around the World with Reporters.
A scene of desperation transformed into one of horror in the waning days of the U.S.-led occupation. Two terrorist attacks on Kabul airport, claimed by Daesh. Dozens killed, among them children and U.S. troops. Hundreds more injured. British troops were spared this time. The U.K. Prime Minister says he's sticking to the evacuation plans.
The military, the Foreign Office teams, the Home Office, the Border Force teams are there getting people through as fast as they can still. And we're going to keep going up until the last moment.
That last moment comes on August 31st. Thousands, including British troops and eligible Afghans, are yet to be evacuated. And the threat of more attacks is looming. Pressure on the government over its handling of the crisis is mounting.
The Foreign Secretary shouts now, but he stayed on holiday while our mission in Afghanistan was disintegrating. You cannot coordinate an international response from the beach.
It's a shambolic end to a 20-year-long U.S.-led occupation, leaving ordinary Afghans to fend for themselves in a country torn by decades of war.
They invaded on a pretext, which was a false pretext, and then for 20 years they've spent $2 to $3 trillion destroying that country. The future in that regard is tough for the Afghani people. They're starting from a very low base as one of the poorest countries on earth, but there are resourceful, ingenious people who are well capable of lifting themselves out of their current situation.
The UK followed the US and their NATO allies into Afghanistan in 2001, purportedly to topple the Taliban, only to hand the country back to the militant group two decades later.
Imperialism invades for reasons of extraction of material wealth, to dominate markets, to dominate labor, to dominate resources. They had a geostrategic policy to dominate the oil of that region. Forget their talk about green energy. They want to extract the maximum fossil fuels from the Middle East and dominate every government, any government which stands in their way and is non-compliant.
The Kabul airport attacks will probably not be the last ones. A taste of what to expect in post-occupation Afghanistan.
Experts say what's happening in Afghanistan right now is another crisis created by an illegal war waged by the U.S., the U.K., and other NATO countries. Another example that military invasion or intervention is not conducive to stability or lasting peace. Saeed Riza, London.
Turkey still seems to be undecided over the issue of the Kabul airport. The Turkish president said Ankara is still yet to decide on a request by the Taliban to run the airport. This came in a presser held in Atatürk Airport ahead of a trip the president is taking to Sarajevo. After Turkey's decision to withdraw troops located at the Kabul airport, the Taliban asked Turkey's assistance in operating the airport. Ankara says it isn't against the idea. However, there are certain things that the Taliban should provide first, such as securing the airport, especially after the latest bombing that took place on Thursday.
The Taliban have made a request regarding the operation of Kabul airport. They say we'll ensure security and you can operate it. But we have not made a decision yet because there's always the possibility of death and such things there.
Turkish president said the hesitation is due to several factors. The main one is the current power vacuum, assuring that a decision will be made once a new government is formed and security is prevailed in Afghanistan. He added that commercial flights to Kabul will not be resumed now. Turkey urged the Taliban earlier to form an inclusive government, which includes former Afghan leaders. Ankara said those politicians have a certain credibility internationally and would help in ensuring political stability. Turkey is currently working to evacuate its citizens from Afghanistan. However, it seems that Ankara plans to accept Taliban's offer to run the airport, assuring that it is very important to keep the airport functioning to help receive aid supplies. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Italian government is considering further expanding its Green Pass scheme, which is part of a plan that aims to have 80% of its citizens vaccinated against the pandemic by the end of September. Despite a significant recent slowdown in the vaccination rate, about 60% of the population has received both doses of COVID-19 vaccine in Italy so far. The government is now considering making it a requirement for employees to show proof of vaccination, testing or recovery at workplaces, including public offices and supermarkets.
La Sicilia, al primo, all'ultimo...
Mind you, the Sicily region, which has the lowest number of vaccinated people, could soon be classified as a high-risk red zone. The vast majority of those in intensive care units these days have not been vaccinated, and the Green Pass scheme serves the purpose of changing their mind.
Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has repeatedly said that the use of the Green Pass scheme is the only alternative to a new lockdown. However, a conspicuous number of Italians are opposing the government's anti-COVID rules that they say infringe on their civil liberties.
Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID Green Pass. Earlier this month, protests were held in several Italian cities against the introduction of new measures requiring proof of vaccination.
L'essere umano è così, non siamo mai tutti...
That's how people are made. We cannot agree on everything, but the vaccine and the Green Pass is the way to go.
Enough with excuses. We are not kids. Maybe our authorities should be more severe with those who refuse to get vaccinated.
Since August 6, the Green Pass has been required in order to enter cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the pass will also be a requirement for all teachers and other school staff. However, the National Association of Head Teachers warned on Wednesday that schools are not equipped to check all the students' vaccine passports. Max Civili, Rome.
Representative of the World Health Organization to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Dr. Jafar Hussain, has visited one of the main vaccination centers in capital Tehran to closely monitor the process of vaccination. In a country where the Delta variant of the coronavirus is killing almost 700 people on a daily basis. During his visit, he learned about different phases of the process, both before and after the vaccination. The WHO representative said that despite sanctions and economic problems, Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccines has been delayed for different reasons.
Iran is a country which has paid already for 16.8 million doses from COVAX, already paid with all the economic sanctions, everything it is facing. The problem is that because of the major outbreaks in other part of the world, like India, like Brazil and other, the vaccine availability globally reduced. What our Director General is recommending to every country head of the state, that it is a whole of society, whole of government approach to control COVID. Not only government can do it, not only WHO can do it, not only other UN, not only private, everybody has to join hand.
The number of outpatients with COVID-19 has decreased by almost 2% this week. We anticipate that the number of hospitalizations will even come down next week.
Iran's death toll from COVID-19 has exceeded 100,000. The rapid rise in COVID-19 cases and deaths in the past weeks has prompted Iranian officials to make utmost efforts to import more vaccines and accelerate the vaccination pace.
According to official reports, almost 10% of the Iranian population have already received two jabs of the COVID-19 vaccines. Experts say the pace is too slow. Accordingly, the new Iranian government has vowed to take all necessary measures to to accelerate the vaccination pace and manage the pandemic as soon as possible. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In its latest saber-rattling against Iran, Israel has said it may have to resort to military action against the Islamic Republic. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz made the threat, accusing Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon. He said military action must be considered as a plan B to prevent Iran from accessing the materials for a nuke. Meanwhile, the chief of the staff of the Israeli military made a similar threat, saying the regime is speeding up its, quote, operational plans against Iran. He also noted that Israel has recently approved a military budget to expand its capabilities against the Islamic Republic. Israel's blatant confessions of its warmongering policies come as it points to recent increases in uranium enrichment as evidence that Iran is racing toward producing a bomb. Israel has been alleging that Iran is trying to build nuclear weapons since the 1980s, but it has failed to produce any evidence to support its claims.
Israeli aggression and attack against the Islamic Republic of Iran will be a matter of the existence of the Zionist entity. They are trying to bother from one time to time by cyber, digital, electronic warfare, but Iran is proven its capability of equality and competition among superpowers in this field.
Iran, on the other hand, has pledged that any aggression against it will be met with a decisive response regardless of where it comes from.
No one in Iran takes this seriously. The Israeli regime has just ended a major catastrophic loss in its conflict with the Palestinian people. So when the Israelis cannot defeat a Palestinian people who are surrounded in a concentration camp called Gaza, then the Israeli regime is in no position to talk about military confrontation with Iran.
Moreover, Iranian officials have on many occasions stressed that Tehran does not want a war, but that Iran will give a crushing response to aggressors. Israel says it wants to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear arms, while Tel Aviv remains the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. In 2008, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said Israel holds at least 150 nuclear weapons. It was the first time a U.S. president publicly acknowledged Israel's atomic arsenal.
Suicide bombers set off two blasts in Afghanistan's capital Kabul on Thursday. The bombings took place outside Hamid Karzai International Airport as thousands were awaiting evacuations following a Taliban takeover of Kabul. Casualties included Afghan civilians and American forces. The U.S. troops suffered their heaviest casualty toll in a single incident in Afghanistan since 2011. In response, President Joe Biden promised punishment for the perpetrators. Biden, under enormous pressure over his administration's handling of the Afghan crisis, said the airlift would continue.
We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay. We will not be deterred by terrorists. We will not let them stop our mission. We will continue the evacuation.
More than 100,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept into power on August 15. The Taliban had allowed the U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31 deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. Analysts believe the U.S. has failed to achieve any of its objectives.
Despite spending $200 million per day over the past 20 years, accumulating well in excess of some $2-3 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money, despite sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops our youth, our sisters and brothers who are now traumatized, some lost life and limb. U.S. imperialism has very clearly lost. They've been kicked out by an indigenous resistance.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan with the stated goal of toppling the Taliban and improving security there. 20 years on, nothing has changed on the ground except the death of tens of thousands of innocent civilians. That, along with the current chaotic pullout, has more than ever raised questions on Washington's real intention about this Afghanistan operation.
After 5 days of marathon debates in Parliament over the credentials of President Raisi's cabinet choices, the final voting was held. All but one of the 19 proposed ministers won the Parliament's confidence. Parliament gave no confidence to Hossein Barghouti, the proposed education minister. With 76 votes in favor, 193 against, and 18 abstentions. In his address to Parliament, President Raisi said his cabinet will start its work as soon as the following day. He says he will not waste an hour to solve the country's problems.
After the vote of confidence is over, we will kickstart our activities with the new cabinet as of tomorrow. Our country is grappling with serious issues, and we must not waste even an hour to address them. Issues such as the fight against the coronavirus and the need to speed up nationwide vaccination will be on top of our agenda.
The ministers of defense, foreign affairs, and intelligence were among the nominees with the highest votes. Lawmakers say this signals that Parliament shares the same approach with the government over foreign policy and national security.
This is meaningful. It shows that Parliament will support the plans of the new ministers. And as the President says, the new cabinet will work throughout the day to solve the problems of the country.
Ebrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament 2 weeks ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then started reviewing the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week, and in the open sessions for the past 5 days. With just one nominee dropping out of the list, it seems that the new government will not face serious friction with Parliament in its job. Raisi now has 3 months to introduce a new name for education minister, and until then, a caretaker will be appointed to run the ministry. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's parliament.
Thousands of Palestinians were injured in a protest east of the city of Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip, where Israeli army fired live bullets and tear gas on protesters who came calling for an end to the blockade imposed by Israel. The mass protest organized by Islamic and National Forces comes as a part of the popular resistance activities that demands giving Palestinians their rights and allow the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip after the latest escalation.
Palestinians came here to stress the importance of the popular resistance with all means. They also demand that their human rights and called for an end to the blockade imposed for 15 years now. Palestinians are only calling for their rights to live with dignity. Israeli regime should be aware that the resistance will support its people and it will force the Israeli regime to accept the Palestinians' demands.
Palestinian factions warned the Israeli regime in a press conference during the rally that they won't accept any delay in the reconstruction process and ending of the crippling siege imposed for 15 years that provoked Palestinians' anger, stressing that the Israeli policies won't break the Palestinian willingness.
The Israeli crimes against Palestinians have led them to come here to voice their anger. The Israeli regime must end the blockade and the Gaza Strip. Palestinians will keep to resist against the occupation regime.
Earlier, Palestinians held a similar protest where an Israeli soldier was critically injured and dozens of Palestinians were shot in clashes with the Israeli army. These protests held by Palestinians aim to expose the Israeli crimes amid the silence of the international community.
We call for an end to this suffocating blockade that has deteriorated our lives. This protest aims to find a way out of our misery. This condition is unacceptable. International community must give Israel a punishment for its crimes here.
Tensions along the separation fence are still ongoing as Palestinian protesters here came to express their refusal of the Israeli blockade and demand allowing the reconstruction of Gaza following an 11-day escalation. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
A special relationship, a term coined after the Second World War by then-British Prime Minister Winston Churchill to describe his country's close bilateral ties with former colony the U.S., from economic to cultural to military. Decades later, that supposed strong bond seems to exist in all but name.
It was never special. We already discussed the Suez crisis where the U.S., you know, basically told Britain to get out of the way, slapped it aside like a little child, a recalcitrant child. Tony Blair was the last British Prime Minister who really put a lot of political capital into this so-called special relationship. The price has been thousands of British soldiers killed, over 457 in Afghanistan alone.
Successive U.S. presidents have dealt serious blows to this transatlantic alliance, from Ronald Reagan, who ordered the invasion of Grenada, a Commonwealth country, when Margaret Thatcher was at number 10, the supposed acme of this special relationship, all the way to Trump and now Biden, who ordered the Afghanistan pullout without consulting the UK.
It gives lie to the idea that there ever was a special relationship. It only existed in the deluded minds of British mandarins and British political elites, because they felt they still wanted to feel that Britain was a great power, and that they, even though they didn't have an empire, they still retain an empire state of mind. And that is now being blown right out of the water with the fall of Afghanistan.
In a sign of heightened tensions, the reaction from a man who got the UK involved in US-led wars in Afghanistan and later Iraq, and is a great believer in this special relationship. He has called Biden's decision imbecilic.
A policy can't be decided by slogan. It's got to be decided on the basis of a strategy, and that's a different thing. And that's really the purpose of what I was saying.
With or without a strategy, it's happening. As U.S. troops evacuate defeated, so must their British peers, just as they went into the country in September 2001. The Taliban have ruled out any extension of the occupation.
If they are intent on continuing the occupation, so it will provoke a reaction.
The exit from Afghanistan is a chaotic one, and the fury at number 10 over being ignored and humiliated is palpable, offering a window into the state of the UK-US relations.
Theirs is a special relationship perennially skewed in Washington's favor, and where junior partner, the UK, plays the role of obedient sidekick. Saeed Pourreza, London.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
America has an accountability problem. In fact, if the COVID-19 disaster, the January 6th Capitol attack, and the Trump years are any indication, the American lexicon has essentially dispensed with the term accountability. This should come as no surprise. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Karen Greenberg, writer. This article is published under the heading America's Accountability Problem. Stay tuned for more. America has an accountability problem. In fact, if the COVID-19 disaster, the January 6th Capitol attack, and the Trump years are any indication, the American lexicon has essentially dispensed with the term accountability. And this should come as no surprise. After all, there is nothing particularly new about this. In the Bush years, those who created a system of indefinite offshore detention at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, those who implemented the CIA global torture program and the National Security Agency's warrantless surveillance policy, not to mention those who purposely took Americans to war based on lies about non-existent Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, were neither dismissed, sanctioned, nor punished in any way for obvious violations of the law. Nor has Congress passed significant legislation of any kind to ensure that all encompassing abuses like these will not happen again. Now, early in the Biden era, any determination to hold American officials responsible for such past wrongdoing, even the president who helped launch an assault on the Capitol, seems little more than a fantasy. It may be something to discuss, rail against, or even make promises about, but not actually reckon with. Not if you're either a deeply divided Congress or a Department of Justice that has compromise itself repeatedly in recent years. Under other circumstances, of course, those would be the two primary institutions with the power to pursue genuine accountability in a meaningful way for extreme and potentially illegal government acts. Today, if thought about at all, accountability, whether in the form of punishment for misdeeds or meaningful reform, has been reduced to a talking point. With that in mind, let's take a moment to consider the Biden administration's approach to accountability so far. Even before Donald Trump entered the Oval Office, the country was already genuinely averse to accountability. When President Obama took office in January 2009, he faced the legacy of the George W. Bush administration's egregious disregard for laws and norms in its extra-legal post-9/11 so-called War on Terror. From day one of his presidency, Obama made clear that he found his predecessor's policies unacceptable by both acknowledging and denouncing those crimes. But he insisted that they belonged to the past, fearing that the pursuit of punishment would involve potentially ugly encounters with former officials and would seem like political retribution in a country increasingly divided and on edge. He clearly decided that it wouldn't be worth the effort. Ultimately, as he said about interrogations, detentions, and so forth, it was best for the U.S. to look forward as he opposed to looking backward. True to the president's word, the Obama administration refused to hold former officials responsible for violations of fundamental constitutional and legal issues. Among those who escaped retrospective accountability were Vice President Dick Cheney, who orchestrated the invasion of Saddam Hussein's Iraq based on lies, the lawyer in the Justice Department's official of legal counsel, John Hu, who in his infamous torture memos justified the enhanced interrogation of so-called War on Terror prisoners, and Secretary of War, Donald Rumsfeld, who created a Bermuda Triangle of injustice at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In terms of reform, Obama did ensure a degree of meaningful change, including decreeing an official end to the CIA torture of prisoners of war. But too much of what happened remained unaddressed and lay in wait for abuse at the hands of some irresponsible future president. As a result, many of the sins that were at the heart of the never-ending response to the 9/11 attacks have become largely forgotten history, leaving many potential crimes unaddressed. And even more sadly, the legacy of accountability's demise only continues. Biden and his team entered office facing a brand new list of irregularities and abuses by high-ranking officials, including President Trump. In this case, the main events demanding accountability had occurred on the domestic front. The January 6th insurrection, the egregious mishandling of the pandemic, and the interference in 2020 presidential election, and also the use of Department of Justice for political ends, all awaited investigation after Inauguration Day. At the outset, the new government dutifully promised that some form of accountability would indeed be forthcoming. On January 15th, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that she planned to convene an independent commission to thoroughly investigate the Capitol riots, later pledging to look into facts and causes of that assault on Congress. Attorney General nominee Merrick Garland similarly promised, "If confirmed, I will supervise the prosecution of white supremacists and others who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. Meanwhile, signaling some appetite for holding his predecessor accountable during the presidential campaign, Joe Biden had already ruled out the possibility of extending a pardon to Donald Trump. In that way, he ensured that, were he elected, numerous court cases against the president and his Trump organization would be open to prosecution. Even as Noah Bookbinder, the executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, recently suggested, reviving of the obstruction of justice charges that had been central to the Mueller investigation of 2016 presidential election. Six months after Joe Biden took office, there has been no firm movement toward accountability by his administration. On the question of making Donald Trump and his allies answer for their misdeeds, the appetite of this administration so far seems wanting, notably, for example, when it comes to the role of president may have played in instigating the Capitol attack. Sadly, Pelosi's call for an independent commission to investigate that insurrectionary moment passed the House but fell victim last month to the threat of a filibuster and was blocked in the Senate. Trump's disastrous mishandling of the pandemic, potentially responsible for staggering numbers of American deaths, similarly seems to have fallen into the territory of unaccountability. The partisan divisions of Congress continue to stall a COVID-19 investigation. National security expert and journalist Peter Bergen, for instance, called for a commission to address the irresponsible way the highest levels of government dealt with the pandemic, but the idea failed to gain traction. It matters not at all that numerous journalists, including Lawrence Wright, Michael Lewis, and Nicholson Baker, have impressively documented the mishandling of the pandemic in the United States. Such disastrous acts included early denials of lethality of the disease, the disavowal of pandemic perpetrators' plans, the dismantling of the very government office meant to respond to pandemics, the presidential promotion of quick cures, a disregard for wearing masks early on, and so much else, all of which contributed to a generally chaotic governmental response in the U.S., which ultimately cost tens of thousands of lives. In truth, a congressional investigation into either the Capitol riots or the Trump administration's mishandling of the pandemic might never have led to actual punitive accountability. After all, 9/11 Commission touted as the gold standard for such investigations did nothing of the sort. While offering a reputable history of the terror threat that resulted in the attacks of 9/11-2001, and a full-scale summary of government missteps and lapses that led to that moment, the 9/11 report did not take on the mission of pointing fingers and demanding accountability. In a recent interview with former New York Times reporter Philip Shannon, whose 2008 book, the Commission punctured that group's otherwise stellar reputation. Just security editor Ryan Goodman offered this observation. An important lesson from your book is the conscious trade-off that 9/11 Commission members made in prioritizing having a unanimous final report, which sacrificed their ability to promote the interest of accountability, such as identifying and naming senior government officials whose acts or omissions were responsible for the lapses in U.S. national security before the attack. Shannon added that trade-off between accountability and unanimity was acknowledged by Commission staff members frustrated by the absence of what thought should have been the report's most important and controversial conclusions. And signs of the difficulty of facing any kind of accountability are now evident inside the Department of Justice, too. Despite initial rhetoric to the contrary from Attorney General Merrick Garland, the department has shown little appetite for redress when it comes to those formerly in the highest post. And that reality should bring to mind the similar reluctance of Barack Obama, the president who originally nominated Garland unsuccessfully to the Supreme Court. For anyone keeping a scorecard of DOJ actions regarding Trump-era excesses, the record is slim indeed. While the department did at least abandon any possible prosecution of former National Security Advisor John Bolton for supposedly disclosing classified information in his memoir in his time, in the Trump administration, Garland also announced that he would not pursue several matters that could have brought to light information about President Trump's abuse of power. In May, for instance, the department appealed a court order called for the release of the full version of a previously heavily redacted DOJ memo advising then-Attorney General Bill Barr that the evidence in the Mueller report was not sufficient to support a conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt that the president violated the obstruction of justice statutes. In fact, the Mueller report did not exonerate Trump, as Mueller himself would later testify in Congress, and as hundreds of federal prosecutors would argue in a letter written in the wake of the report's publication, saying, "Each of us believes that the conduct of President Trump described in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report would result in multiple felony charges for obstruction of justice."
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the Almighty, dear friends, Salamu Alaikum. You are listening to the program Lantern from IRIB English Radio. As usual, we have an interesting story at the first step of this episode. This is a story entitled A Poor Young Boy and the Dog. A few days ago, I landed at an airport and took a cab to my scheduled destination. I was enjoying the busy traffic with people rushing in every possible direction. Then we got stranded at a very busy intersection. As we waited to turn green, my eyes met up with a poor young boy, about 12 years old. He removed a piece of bread from his pocket and took a bite. As he was about to take his next bite, a stray dog wagged his tail looking at him. Without hesitation, he sat down and put the bread on the road for the dog to eat. The dog sniffed and walked away. The boy waited until he was sure the dog was gone. Then he picked up the bread and ate it. My heart cried and wanted to walk up to the boy, but before I could open the door, the signal turned green and our car drove away. I kept thinking about the boy, and later during my evening meal, I realized that I was thinking of approaching the boy, but never did. I could have stopped the car and walked up to him, which again I never did. I learned one of the biggest lessons in my life, which the boy taught me without a conversation. He taught me to share with love and happiness without any hesitation. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa binastain. In this episode, we are going to talk about the virtues of helping the needy in Islam. From the Islamic perspective, those people who can help other people shouldn't fall behind receiving this virtue, this religious virtue indeed. There's a piece of hadith from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam in which he said, whoever makes another believer happy or delighted has indeed made me delighted. And anybody who makes me delighted has made Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala very much delighted. Now we find that those people who can help the whole community, their own religious community, financially, culturally, or for example in other ways, are expected to discharge the duties toward the needy. Suppose that in a human community the rich are always thoughtful about the needy, and wherever they find any needy person, they sincerely help them in order to solve their problems. In that community, we find that by way of any kind of psychosocial complex would be formed, in the minds and in the demeanor and behavior of those people who find themselves not belonging to the upper classes of the community. On the other hand, we find that those people, who are regarded as belonging to the well-to-do class of society or community, we find that they are ready to share the gains, some portions of their properties, with those people who are really in need of receiving such kind of financial or cultural or educational assistance. Another benefit or another gain that can be obtained through helping the needy is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives abundance, grants abundance to the wealth of those people who need, who help other people, especially the needy. Yet in this regard, we find that Satan intervenes and tempts those people who may want to help other people and not to do so, and because deducting some money or some budget for one's own pocket may give or may lead to, gradually may lead to one's, for example, turning into financially unfavorable situation or becoming not that much wealthy in the long run. And in this regard, we find that those people who are not that much inclined to help other people may reason that helping other people, helping the needy, would lead to their own poverty. Yet in this regard, especially particularly in this context and in situation, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala instructs people in this way. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم. Those people who pay alms out of their own properties in the cause of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's like one grain of wheat, which is planted in the earth, and finally it comes out with seven sheaves, and in each sheave you can find 100 grains. I mean, it's multiplied. In the beginning, only one grain of wheat was planted, but in the long run, we find that 700 grains of wheat are produced. This is, of course, an analogy, and in this regard, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants us to imagine, to come up with imagining this type of, I mean, the favorable consequences of helping the needy. Yet, there's a piece of hadith from the sixth infallible Imam, Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, in which he mentioned that giving alms to the needy is in fact compensating the one's duties, and it leaves behind grace and blessings. We hope to be among those people who help the needy. Thank you.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Sayyid Muhammad Ridwi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani la'in rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear sisters and brothers in Iman, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. The coronavirus outbreak is truly putting families and nations to test. Some people are fortunate enough to maintain themselves during the economic downturn, but there are many more who are financially struggling. Many governments are helping citizens through various initiatives. This contrasts with other regions where there is a stark lack of support. For example, in Detroit, Michigan, water was cut off for those who could not pay their bills. Millions in India are literally surviving on charity while the country is on lockdown without a strong relief system. Tanzania is withholding information and refusing to implement a lockdown for monetary reasons. Nicaragua refuses to acknowledge the existence of the crisis, leaving citizens to self-implement safety measures. And Kenya is urging people to stay indoor while at the same time demolishing the homes of 5,000 people. And so while the countries who are implementing aid may not be doing it perfectly, it is still a praiseworthy gesture of help. On an individual level, there are many who are helping out friends, relatives, and others during this trying time. Many more are helping the poor through charitable organizations around the world. So if you know relatives or friends who are in need, help them out however you can, in a safe manner according to social distancing. If you don't know of anyone in need, then donate to relevant charitable organizations.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Ana bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.